From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Just as there's a wage gap dividing men and women at work, there's a leisure gap that separates them at home. On today's Fresh Air, sociologist Arlie Hochschild looks at the inequalities that still exist in two-career families. Also today, we travel to the Great Plains with writer Ian Fraser. He says he thinks of the Great Plains as a time park. Rock critic Ken Tucker plays the tunes that are topping the charts overseas, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new Spike Lee movie, Do the Right Thing. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Two-thirds of all mothers are now in the labor force. There's no more time in the day than there was when wives and mothers stayed home, but there's twice as much to get done. So working mothers come home from their jobs and face an exhausting second shift, taking care of their families and homes. The second shift is the title of a new book about the division of labor at home in two-career families. My guest is the author, Arlie Hochschild. She's a professor of sociology at Berkeley and has written for Mother Jones, Harper's, and Psychology Today. Her study is based on interviews with 50 couples from 1980 through 1988. Hochschild concludes that we're in the middle of a stalled revolution. Women have made gains towards equality on the job, but married working mothers haven't yet won equality in their own homes.
What's happened in the last 10 and 15 years is that women have gone into the labor force, into mainly full-time jobs. But men have not, in the same measure, shared the work that's left at home of making a home a home. So it's the work of the second shift, the work you do after an eight-hour day when you come home to cook a meal or bathe your children. And that's not being shared equally, and I think it's a very important source of strain in modern marriage.
Now, you describe your own situation as having been very good when you were bringing up your children when they were young, and you say your husband cared for your children like a mother. What made you realize the urgency of this story?
Well, I have an academic career. My husband is a journalist, so we've had more flexibility in our jobs than other couples. But what's really brought this home to me is teaching a class called Gender and Society at the University of California, Berkeley. And I see 18, 19, 20-year-olds who feel like the happy inheritors of the feminist revolution. They feel it's already happened, and they simply have to go into the labor force and get the jobs which are now available to them. And they don't think there's anything more to do, whereas interviewing couples for this book really made me realize that we are stuck in a revolution that stalled midway, and there are enormous strains going on in the two-job family, which is the modal family in America today. So it seemed very urgent to me to talk to the younger generation and warn them of what's coming up ahead.
You're constantly in your book comparing the kind of magazine and advertising image of the successful working woman and mother with the real image, and the photographed image we've seen is what?
The photographed image seems to me like a cultural cover-up. Here's this picture of the woman with the flying hair. She has a briefcase in one hand, and she has a happy child in the other hand, and she's striding confidently forward. And the suggestion is that her success has to do with her personal qualities. You know, how organized are you? How much energy do you have? How much sleep can you do without? All of these things seem to promise the solution to joining a full-time job with child rearing. And out of the picture is the picture of a man. Out of the picture is the context that would make her life livable. That is flexible jobs, part-time work, on-site daycare. It's a personalization of what is a fundamentally social and structural problem. And What's haunting to me is that working mothers themselves look at this image, and since they can't get their husbands to share at home, and since they're resentful of it, and since they often cover over this resentment, they look to this image for some source of respect, and they say, yes, I'm like that, you know, I'm on the go, I'm well organized, and they take some comfort in it. But it's a sad comfort to take.
Well, the real image that you found is that women who are both mothers and working people are always exhausted, they have no leisure time, and they frequently find themselves rushing the children because they have to keep to such a rigid schedule in order to get everything done.
That's right. The irony is that women are often the time and motion people of the family, like there was a time and motion person in the corporation in the factory floor. So there's someone who says, hurry up, it's time, 7 minutes for the bath, who can get dressed first, finish your cereal quick, out the door. And women become lightning rods to the frustrations and aggressions that develop when people are hurried up, when there is a speed up in family life. And ironically, these are the women who suffer the most from it because they are carrying the load at home, but they're the people who get blamed the most for it, too. Actually, in my research, I found that women averaged an extra month a year of full-time days doing the unpaid labor of the home. We could call it a leisure gap that exists between men and women at home, analogous to the wage gap in the labor force.
Arlie Hochschild is my guest. She's a sociologist and journalist and author of the new book, The Second Shift, Working Parents and the Revolution at Home. Now, you found that women who work basically have three jobs if they're parents. They have their working job, you know, in the office or wherever. They have their parenting job and the housework job, whereas their husbands usually have two jobs, the work away from home and either child rearing or housework, but usually not both of those.
That's right. Women are more likely to do two things at the same time. They're also more likely to do the daily chores. For example, everyone has to eat every day three times, but the oil doesn't have to be changed in the car every day. So women more often take jobs like feeding that are daily. Men more often take jobs like changing the oil in the car that can be done at their leisure. So, and women more often take mental responsibility for running the home. And all of these things make women feel the strain more keenly. They talked about the second shift as more their issue. They talked about how much sleep they could get. They talked about sleep the way a starving person talks about food. You know, they'll say, well, oh, I get 6.5 hours sleep, or I can get by on 7. And they talk about the big sleep-in when they get to sleep in on Saturday mornings. But they talked with great interest about sleep because they weren't getting enough of it. Mm-hmm. Men didn't talk that way.
Now, I want to ask you about one couple who you interviewed and spent a lot of time with. You gave them the names of Evan and Nancy. I thought this was an interesting case study in the sense that Nancy really tried every strategy she could think of to get her husband to share in the parenting and in the housework. And he kept resisting every step of the way, forgetting to cook dinner, forgetting it was his day. And finally she gave up, thinking that, you know, it's really stupid to break up the marriage over this. So in her attempts to keep the marriage together, she just decided to take on more responsibilities and let him get away with less. Then you start to enumerate all the mental tricks that someone in Nancy's position ends up playing to resign themselves to the way things are going to be. Would you enumerate some of them for us?
Yes. To back up a bit, Nancy still felt resentful that she carried the second shift and that Evan refused to. But she didn't want to feel resentful. She wanted to feel happy and in love with Evan. And yet this resentment was corroding her love of him, despite herself and despite Evan. And so she began to think about Evan in ways that circumscribed her resentment. So, for example, she would begin to compare herself only to other women and not to Evan or other men. So she would say, well, a working mother is very different from other kinds of women. If you have a if you're a mother, then you have to do the work at home, and that comes with the territory. That's how it is to be a woman. Before, she had compared herself to Evan and said, look, Evan, you could do this. But she tried to curtail those comparisons because they led her to dwell on the inequality that led her to be resentful, and she was frightened of her resentment. Another thing she did was to think of her work at home as a shift. I should say that finally their marriage became so strained that she cut back to part-time work. And then she decided that she should think of her part-time job and her work at home as a shift. So she would work 8 hours, and when making dinner fell on her shift, she didn't resent it. She felt, well, we're both working a shift, and mine's half at work and half at home, so that's all right. His is all at work. And when she thought of it that way, she again didn't get mad. So these were ways of extraordinary and, to me, poignant ways in which she was trying to circumvent resentment. But the irony and sad fact was that she could not, in fact, prevent herself from resenting him for refusing to share the work at home. And this did ultimately corrode their sexual life together, and it led her to bond herself to her young son in a way that excluded Evan from that relationship. And these were ultimately indirect expressions of her resentment about the second shift.
Well, I think also you're making the point here that the price sometimes men pay for not sharing
enough.
In parenting or in housework is that they lose a lot of their relationship with their wives in intimacy and in sexual intimacy as well, because the woman's frequently just too exhausted for sex or doesn't feel intimate enough to really enjoy it.
The men are paying an enormous price right now already for not sharing the second shift, but often they don't connect the resentment they feel at home to the sharing that they're not doing at home.
I think it's important to point out here that, you know, in your study you didn't find that no men were participating equally in this, but rather it was just a disappointing percentage of men, like around 20%.
That's right.
And I don't know, you would think that after all these years of the feminist movement that there'd be more than 20% sharing equally in or at least more equally in parenting and housework. Can we look at some of the reasons why that's not happening?
Well, one reason that's not happening is that men are worried about their identity as providers, and they still feel judged by the world as providers. So in a way, men are in a double bind. At home, they're feeling pressure from their wives to do more at home. And they go out into the work world, and success as a man is still measured by the size of your wallet, and they feel those social pressures. Also, work at home has not been valued in a way. If a woman moves into a job, you know, as a TV caster, or professor, or so on, it seems like a step up from what was permitted for women two generations ago. But for a man to share the work at home, to care for children and care for a home, isn't perceived as a step up, but as a step down, because the whole culture of caring for the home has been devalued. And what I think we have to do is revalue it. It's really time for a whole cultural shift.
Do you think that sometimes men are in the kind of bind where they can't afford to put in too much more time at home because in order to keep their job and to keep the income that they've become accustomed to, that they've just got to work really long hours?
No, that's not it. Mm-hmm. I found no relationship between the number of hours men work and the amount of work they do at home. And other studies have not found that. It's surprising, but men who work 8 hours are no more likely to pick up the work at home than men who work 10 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is something interesting you found, that the actions of men and women in the home don't necessarily correlate to what they think of as being their gender philosophy. That you found places where the couple thinks of themselves as feminists, yet there really isn't much sharing going on, and other couples that think of themselves as traditionalists, and there's much more sharing going on. That's kind of hard to explain.
Well, it's true. People are complicated, and what they say they believe doesn't often relate to what they feel about those beliefs, nor does it relate to what they do. Let me give you an example of a traditional couple, both of whom agreed that it was a great sadness that the wife had to work. They both felt it would be ideal if she could stay home and tend the house and children. But she worked an 8-hour day. Okay, so they were traditionalists. The man said, I believe the man's the head of the household, and I don't see any reason for that to change. But this wife, like egalitarian wives, felt a strain in having to work both a full-time job and the work at home. And what she did was indirectly invite her husband to share the second shift by circumventing their ideology. Carmen would cook the rice, but she'd always burn it. So really, Frank could cook the rice better. Carmen couldn't remember the numbers on her Versatel code, so Frank would have to work the sidewalk banker machine. Carmen couldn't drive a car, so, well, Frank had to do the shopping with her. So through one cultivated incompetence after another, she invited Frank through the back door into the second shift, and he, again, holding on to his traditional views of manhood, chivalrously helped a woman out instead of thinking this was his role. But in fact, this man did almost half of the second shift. Not quite half, because he might have stayed an inch away from it. It might have seemed unseemly. But he did a lot more than men I also interviewed who talked a far more feminist line.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Arlie Hochschild, and she's a sociologist who's written a new book called The Second Shift, Working Parents and the Revolution at Home. And we're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Arlie Hochschild, and her new book, The Second Shift, is about couples in which both parents work, and she's found that equality in the home actually hasn't caught up to equality in the workplace. Did you find that there were class differences?
We don't
differences?
Have equality in the workplace, by the way.
Right, yes.
and they're related, the two things. The wage gap is related, I think, to the leisure gap at home.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that there are class differences at home in how couples deal with equality?
I found that in the working class, men did slightly more work at home, but believed in doing it less. In the upper middle class, I found that men believed in doing it more, but actually did it less.
Well, in part of the middle and upper middle class, many two-career couples are now having live-in help, or help that comes in once or twice a week to clean. There's more of a salary for babysitters as needed. That would seem to be a tremendous help in evening out the sides between both parents, and also freeing up the husband and wife to have more time for themselves and for each other and for their children.
Well, it's nationwide. Only 15% of working couples have any household help. And it certainly doesn't solve the problem for those working couples where the wife or husband are the household help. What we need are solutions that apply for everyone. And I found that even in those privileged couples who do have household help, men still do the more preferred activity. Of all the work men and women put into the home, women do proportionately more housework, which is generally less preferred than childcare, and men do more childcare. In other words, men put less time in, but a higher proportion of that time is dealing with the children. And of the time they devote to the children, women tend to do more bathing and feeding, and men tend to do more trips to the zoo and playing ball, more sort of cream time, you might say, with the children. So ironically, working mothers get less time to mother, even when there is household help.
Mm-hmm. I would like to hear your impressions of the mommy track, the theory we've been hearing lately that working mothers can't possibly devote as much time to their job as women who aren't parents, and that there should be two tracks, one for working mothers and the other for working women who don't have children.
I think that raising children does take time. You need quality time, but you also need quantity time. So that's the first thing I want to say, and I would like that work to be honored, but I would like to degender it. I would like to see more men doing it as well as women. So, number one, I wouldn't like to see any track at all. Number two, I would like both men and women to have the option of flex time, part-time work, job sharing, on-site daycare. And Felice Schwartz, the author of this idea of the mommy track, suggested that this be offered only to the top 10% of employees, and I would like to see it available to everyone who is the parent of a child.
Well, this way, too, if you were hiring someone, you wouldn't be able to solve the problem of your employee having parenting responsibilities just by hiring a man and shutting out the women. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd have to deal with families whether you're hiring men or women. So you wouldn't be
able
to discriminate against women.
That's right. Imagining this whole pool of men who are free of these obligations, who have families but are family free. There are such men, but I'm arguing that they are really paying for it in the resentment that they daily live with. And in an age of high divorce, that's a very serious problem.
Let's face it, the way work is now, I think it's extremely difficult for men and for women to balance private and personal life.
Do you have any recommendations
for like public policy and enlightened corporate policy that would make life a little bit easier for men and for women?
Yes. You know, it seems like we've spent the last 25 years of the family adapting to the demands of the workplace. And women have gone into the labor force, and they've adopted some of the folk ways of men. And we've called that liberation. But in fact, what we really need now is changes in men and changes in the workplace and in the work culture that permitted men to share parenting and the life of the home. Because family life has become so marginalized that it's almost disappearing. And before this becomes normal, I think it's time for us to push back those pressures that are leading to this to become normal. One way to push those pressures back would be to nail into the place of work the 60s agenda we've talked about of part-time work, flex time, job sharing available to both men and women. And I think we can say to corporations that you're more likely to save your employees, to prevent burnout, to prevent situational depression, to prevent turnover. You're more likely to have an employee who is enormously loyal to you for a long time. And if you take the long-range look, you'll get more out of a happy employee than you do out of an unhappy employee. And you make an employee happy by handling the main problem in his life, which is the conflict between work and family.
Mm-hmm. You know, as you point out in your book, some experts correlate divorce to women working outside the home. You correlate it to something differently. You say couples are more likely to stay together if the man supports his wife in working and participates in the child rearing and work at home. That's what's going to keep a marriage going.
In my study of 50 couples, all of the women worked. So the fact of working couldn't explain why some couples were happy and some couples weren't. What made the difference was the male's participation at home and how willing he was to work at home. I mean, some men helped at home, but grudgingly and unwillingly. But when they, in good spirit, pitched in at home, those were much happier couples. Now, I don't know what's the chicken and what's the egg. It may be that his sharing at home made her happy. I think there's a lot of evidence for that. Women defined love in ways that were related to his participation at home. But it could be that because the couple was happy, they automatically shared. So I don't know what's cause and what's effect, but the two things went together.
Arlie Hochschild is my guest, and she's the author of The Second Shift, Working Parents and the Revolution at Home. You know, some people would walk away from your study and say, see, women have had false expectations all along. It really isn't possible to have a full-time career and young children at home and a happy marriage and keep all of that balanced. You know, you've got to focus on what your priorities are and stick to that.
Well, no, I don't think there's any going back. Women are in the labor force. All the women I interviewed wanted to stay in the labor force. And every other study I've read shows an increase in participation in the labor force. Women are working for the most part because they have to work, because there's been an erosion in the male wage, and they're having to make up for that by working. So I don't think there's any going back, and it's a question of trying to adjust to that fact. And what we have now is that women have changed, but the place of work has not changed, and men haven't changed. And that's what's leading to the strains. And that's why I'm calling this a stalled revolution at the moment. But I don't think there's any going back. There's only going forward. And I'm writing the second shift because I'd like to go forward faster and more gracefully so that there are fewer victims from a stalled revolution.
Okay, Arlie Hochschild, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Well, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Arlie Hochschild's new book, The Second Shift, Working Parents and the Revolution at Home, is published by Viking. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with New York Times reporter Thomas Friedman. He won 2 Pulitzer Prizes for his reporting from Lebanon and Israel, which he covered from 1979 until this past January. His new book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, is about covering the Middle East. It's part history, part analysis, and part autobiography. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Ian Fraser is best known for his humor pieces in the New Yorker magazine, but now Fraser has written a travel book about America's Great Plains. Coming up, Ian Fraser tells us what he found during his 25,000-mile journey around and through the heart of America. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker plays some of the records that are hits today in Europe. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Do the Right Thing, Spike Lee's controversial new movie about urban racism. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Doreen McAllister. The House has adopted new sanctions against China in response to the brutal crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators. The House today voted to suspend trade and development programs, to ban the sale of police equipment, and to limit transfer of high technology and nuclear materials or components. While stopping short of saying the White House will veto the measure, Secretary of State James Baker says the administration won't support it. Amnesty International says it fears Chinese authorities may execute hundreds of the activists rounded up in the crackdown on democracy. The London-based organization said today its concern was based on China's notorious record of executions and unfair trials during the 1980s. There was no immediate comment from Chinese authorities. President Bush today announced a package of campaign reforms that would eliminate most political action committees and chip away at the privileges of incumbents. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The president asked Congress to join him to help free our electoral system from the grip of special interests. He proposed doing away with most PACs, restricting the ability of state legislatures to gerrymander congressional districts, and limit the ability of incumbents to use free postage to send mail to their constituents. Democrats said his package was partisan, that it strengthened the Republican Party at the expense of the Democrats. The Democrats would like to see some kind of overall limits placed on campaign spending. The president said today he doesn't like that idea. Republican members of Congress maintain that in order to successfully surmount the built-in advantages of Democratic incumbents, they need to be able to spend large amounts of money on campaigns. In the past, campaign reform efforts have always fallen victim to a partisan stalemate in Congress, but members of both parties said today the president's announcement may help their effort to reach a compromise. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
After meeting for more than 2 hours today with President Bush, President Mobutu of Zaire disputed charges of abuses and corruptions in the African nation. Congress has threatened to cut administration-requested aid in response to the charges, but Mobutu told reporters that recent reforms have removed Zaire from a watch list maintained by the UN Commission on Human Rights. For the first time in 6 months, Israel has expelled Palestinians from the Israeli-occupied territories. 8 men were sent to southern Lebanon today. NPR's John Hockenberry reports from Jerusalem.
The 8 men were evenly divided. 4 were from the West Bank, 4 from the Gaza Strip. All had been under arrest for some time prior to their expulsion today. The 8 men were accused by Israel of being involved in ground-level popular committees, the units of political organization during the Palestinian uprising. Fewer than half of the Palestinians had been charged with crimes. The U.S. government has brought pressure on Israel to cease expulsions, which technically are in violation of international law concerning occupation, a law Israel has consistently ignored. Dozens of Palestinians have been expelled since the beginning of the uprising, even though Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin has publicly stated he believes the expulsions have had no deterrent effect on political activity or violence. This is John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
Testimony continued in Rhode Island today. Officials are looking into why a Greek tanker ran aground over the weekend, spilling about 420,000 gallons of heating oil into Narragansett Bay. Federal authorities want the Justice Department to grant immunity to the tanker's helmsman and possibly chief mate so they can testify. The vessel's captain remains confined aboard the ship in lieu of $50,000 bail on pollution charges. Meanwhile, a Delaware official says 75% of the heavy oil that leaked into the Delaware River when a Uruguayan tanker ran aground over the weekend has been cleaned up. In Texas, crews are using handheld skimmers and absorbent pads to complete the cleanup of about 6,000 barrels of oil that leaked into the Houston Ship Channel from a barge that collided with a tanker. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. American rock and roll has influenced music around the world, but that doesn't mean that American records are now at the top of the world charts. Rock critic Ken Tucker brings us up to date on what the hits are overseas.
A glance at Billboard's top 10 these days yields a series of familiar names. Madonna, Tom Petty, Bobby Brown, John Cougar Mellencamp, and number one for the fourth week now, Fine Young Cannibals. In varying degrees, all of these musicians are making worthwhile music, but this week I thought it would be interesting to see what's selling in the rest of the world. Not surprisingly, other countries have different ideas about what's best in popular music at any given time. Billboard magazine has a page called Hits of the World, which contains current record charts from countries including England, Australia, West Germany, and the Netherlands. Scanning the foreign charts, you begin to notice a few names being repeated over and over, like Roxette, an act that has a top 10 single in Britain, West Germany, and Australia. Roxette is a Swedish duo consisting of singers Marie Fredriksson and Per Gessle. They make light, airy pop that finds its anchor in Fredriksson's clear, strong alto. Roxette's international hit right now is called The Look. Walking like a man, hitting like a hammer, she's a juvenile scam. Never was a quitter, tasted like a raindrop, she's got the look. A heavenly bomb, cause heaven's got a number when she's spinning me around. Kissing is a color, her loving is a wild dog, she's got the look. She's got the look. That's Roxette. None of the songs I'm playing today is a major hit in America. Sometimes, like that Roxette song, the single came out here and flopped. In other cases, the music either hasn't yet been released here or has only just come out and it's too soon to calculate its American fortunes. That's the case, for example, with Holly Johnson. Johnson, who's from England, was once half of the brains behind Frankie Goes to Hollywood. Frankie Goes to Hollywood was a huge sensation in England. In the mid-80s, Frankie literally equaled Michael Jackson in popularity over there. And like lots of English sensations, Frankie had a short shelf life. Holly Johnson left Frankie Goes to Hollywood last year and made a solo album called Blast. Its first single was a number one hit in England and Germany this past March. It's only just been released here. This place. That's Holly Johnson, whose wispy little neo-disco tune Americanos is, to my ears, a catchy but bland international hit. Much less of a surprise to me is the worldwide acclaim that Nene Cherry has attracted with her debut album called Raw Like Sushi. Nene Cherry is the stepdaughter of the acclaimed jazz musician Don Cherry. She was born in Sweden, raised in Brooklyn, she's in her 20s, she has two children, and when she sings on one of the songs she's written, I Know Where I'm Going and Where I'm Coming From, she sounds utterly convincing. She's a brand new voice of experience. In America, Nene Cherry has just scored a hit with the song Buffalo Dance. The rest of the world is already enjoying that song's follow-up single, called Manchild. From Monday down to Friday, you're working on another man's car. Or is it in the factory? It doesn't matter. Keep on playing. Finally, we come to the most shocking new success on the international scene. Scanning the charts from all over the world, I was appalled to see the same name popping up. Queen. Yes, Queen, the perfectly dreadful hard rock act featuring the rabbit-toothed Freddie Mercury. You know Queen. Bohemian Rhapsody, We Are the Champions, We Will Rock You. All those big-beat pop anthems perennially on the verge of being fascist rock. The band's new album is, right now, number one on the charts in West Germany and the Netherlands. The album is called, all too appropriately, The Miracle, and I bow to the will of the people. Here's the first single, called, all too appropriately, I Want It All. Just give me what I know.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. The Great Plains have been called the breadbasket of the world, the Dust Bowl, and now vanishing rural America. But to writer Ian Fraser, they're a time park, and I'll let him explain why in a moment. Ian Fraser is best known as a humorist for the New Yorker magazine. But in the fall of 1982, Fraser left New York for Montana. Over the next several years, he drove 25,000 miles back and forth across the Great Plains. His new book, Great Plains, is part history and part personal travelogue. His voyage began with his fantasy of what it would be like to live in Montana.
I'd have a ranch, I'd have horses, I'd have a big video, I'd have a big disc in the yard, I could get 1,000 TV channels, I'd have a library, you know, I'd fish for trout, I'd hunt, you know, people would come visit me, I mean, I'd go back and forth, you know, to the capitals of the world. I mean, I had envisioned a kind of a Hemingway-esque, or I don't know, just an idea of utopia, of just everything, you know. And plus, I'd just write real American great things, you know.
How close did you get to any of this?
Not close at all. I was desperately poor. I mean, I ended up reading about it, was what it came down to, and not being able to live it too much.
Well, let me ask you to read a passage from your book about the Great Plains, and this is a passage about your motivation for exploring them.
Okay. Well, this is what I'm reading. I'm describing a time before I moved out. This is in New York. At parties, I told people, well, I'm going to be moving to Montana soon, and now here I was in Montana. Suddenly, I no longer had any place to dream about. So I started to dream about the Great Plains. For fantasies, the Great Plains are in many respects the perfect place. They're so big you could never know all there is to know about them. Your fantasies could never wear them out. Even the plural in their name seems to make them extend farther into a distant romantic haze. Also, they are a place where I will probably never live. This is important because any place I move, I ruin. Look at the north side of Chicago. Look at Soho. I move in, the rents go up, coffee shops become French restaurants, useful stores close. Don't ask me how I do it, it's just a talent I have. 100 years ago, it was not unusual to hear of single men and women and young couples with families moving out to start farms on the Great Plains. Today you hear of people my age being urban pioneers in some neglected neighborhood, or moving to the suburbs, or moving to Northern California or Washington, or Northwest Montana, like me. You never hear of us moving to the Great Plains.
In your book, you describe the Great Plains as feeling like an enormous time park. Would you describe that?
Well, where I live now in New York, things change in terms of time very quickly. You might not know the person who lived in the apartment that you live in. You might not know the person who was living there before you moved in. On the Great Plains, it's an arid region, like Egypt, other parts of the world that have preserved the past well. Things don't rot and fall apart very quickly there. So, and also, there's no real incentive for someone to tear down and build on the same spot, because there's so much land. So that if you do something, it doesn't work out. You build a house, you don't like it, you just leave it. But on a larger time scale, the Great Plains were probably the leading source of dinosaur finds, dinosaur bones, fossilized bones. Places where events in the Indian Wars took place often are completely unchanged. You can read a description of a battle that took place in 1874 and go back, and the place is the same. And the geographic features are exactly as they were described. So when I call it a time park, I mean it's a place where you're a bit, you're at loose in time, and you can be in the present. You can go to a hotel and watch, or a motel and watch MTV, and you're right now. You can go out and visit a museum, and you're in the Dust Bowl, say. You're talking to people. You can see in a museum photographs of the Dust Bowl, talk to people who are in the Dust Bowl. You can move much more freely in time.
Was it this sense of things remaining unchanged through time that sent you back to read so much history?
Well, yes. Also, if you try and, I mean, in our country now, history has been kind of debased to nostalgia. And so for people my age, you can get endless, endless doses of the songs that you listened to in high school, which to me has just totally lost its interest. I don't want to hear Stand By Me again. I've heard it enough. I think it was that produced a larger feeling of claustrophobia, like, can't we see a little bit more of time than just these years when we were in high school? And I just found an incredible appetite to find out about the history of America in the 19th century. It was something that I didn't know that much about, and here at the New York Public Library, in the main reading room, I found a place as much fun as the Great Plains to be in. A place where I could, I could get a book, I could get an original edition of the Journals of Lewis and Clark, published 1815, and open the book, and these old yellow pages would fall apart, it was just a kind of a magical experience for me, and it was something I had visited these places, and it made these events that were described there make more sense to me.
In your collection of humor pieces called Dating Your Mom, you have a piece called Into the American Maw, and it's about your trip driving home from Boston to New York, and it's a parody of the kind of pieces about the savage nightmare journey into the heart of the American dream.
Right.
Did you want to make sure that your new book didn't become the type of thing that you were parodying in that piece?
Right. I think every savage nightmare journey I've ever read has seemed to be kind of too simple, I mean, like, they just, you get a bunch of drugs and alcohol and go careening off in a rented car somewhere. I think that's a childish, I think that that's something maybe you do when you're a kid. So you imagine a person on a savage nightmare journey, right, with a rented car, and, he's driving careening around the place. I just imagine him seen from the point of view of someone who lives in the town when he comes through. I mean, to me, Bonnie and Clyde are a savage nightmare journey in a way. And I just imagine, like, I'm sitting in the gas station and this guy comes in all juiced up on a savage nightmare journey, and I just know he isn't going to see me. I know he isn't going to see the town.
So you think that there's a former travel writer who's blind to the average, to the normal?
And
is looking and projecting.
Yeah, and is trying to It's as if you start out to write a piece already knowing what you're going to say before you interview the person. You know, it's like when you're on a Savage Nightmare journey, you know, it can be kind of hard to, like, visit the Zane Grey Museum or something, you know? And someone says, did you know Zane Grey was a dentist? And you might be too Savage Nightmared out to pay attention to that interesting fact. Say, huh, Zane Grey was a dentist. And then you might miss something interesting like that.
Uh-huh. What got you to move back to New York?
Well, my family lives in the East. My whole family does. Also, I think there was just a plain old literary reason, which is that I had observed that my favorite books about the West, pretty much, a great many of them, were written by people who went out, spent some time there, came back, and wrote the books in the East. Or in Europe. I think that somehow it's easier for me to write about a place I really love when I'm not there. When I was just in Lincoln, Nebraska, and somebody asked me that question, why did I move back? And I said, well, because if I were here in this room, this was a church basement in Lincoln, Nebraska, I might not notice what a neat room it is. But there isn't a room like this in all of New York, and now when I get back to New York, I'll imagine this room.
Mm-hmm. Ian Fraser, I want to thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Ian Fraser writes for The New Yorker. His new book, Great Plains, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, this evening we'll have a report from West Germany that producer Ira Glass and I prepared after our visit there. This evening we address the question, are the West Germans, given all the complaints they've had against various aspects of NATO policy over the past several months, are they tiring of the alliance and of their relationship with the U.S. and of what we used to all agree was the Cold War?
What else are you following?
Campaign finance reform. And we'll be hearing about Mobutu Sese Seko, the president of Zaire, who's visiting George Bush today. He arrives very much the peacemaker, having negotiated the Angola deal recently. But back home, we learn he's known much more for graft.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Spike Lee's first feature film, She's Gotta Have It, was a critical hit. His second, School Days, was a critical flop. His new film, Do the Right Thing, has the critics completely divided, and it's perhaps the most controversial movie of the year. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review.
What is Spike Lee trying to do? Start a riot? That's the question a lot of people have posed, and the answer is complicated. No, he's not trying to start a riot. And yes, he is trying to start something, mainly for himself. What he's really trying to do is become the artistic mouthpiece for the black community, and at this, he is succeeding. His new movie, Do the Right Thing, is at once so entertaining and so muddled that it can lend itself to any one of a variety of interpretations. Firebrands can cite it as an incentive to riot, and diplomats can use it to support interracial negotiations. The story, such as it is, takes place on the hottest day of the year in the hottest section of New York, Brooklyn's Bedford-Stuyvesant district. Although this is a clean, peaceful, drug-free Bed-Stuy that exists only in Lee's fantasies. The action centers on Sal's Pizza Parlor, the only white-run business in the neighborhood, and the people who flow in and around it. Sal, played by Danny Aiello. Mookie, the affable delivery boy. Radio Rahim, the kid whose ghetto blaster is the whole of his life and religion. And various other neighborhood characters, including Buggin' Out, the chronic malcontent whose trivial complaint finally sets the movie's racial tinderbox on fire.
Hey, Sal, how come we got no brothers up on a wall here?
You want brothers on a wall? Get your own place. You can do what you want to do. You can put your brothers and uncles and nieces and nephews, your stepfather, stepmother, whoever you want, you see? But this is my pizzeria. American Italians on the wall only.
Yeah, that might be fine, Sal, but you own this. Rarely do I see any American Italians eating in here. All I see is black folks. So since we spend much money here, we do have some say.
Do the Right Thing is relaxed and funny and superficial right up until the end, when a chain of absurdities results in a small race riot and the destruction of Sal's pizza parlor. Since harmless, lovable Mookie, played by Spike Lee himself, delivers the first destructive blow, some observers have decided that the movie supports the view heard in its theme song by Public Enemy, which demands that blacks fight the power, probably with violence. But Do the Right Thing doesn't advocate violence. Sal is clearly painted as a sympathetic character, and his pizza parlor as a beloved part of the neighborhood. And the movie makes fun of the gripes and tensions that lead to Sal's downfall. Lee's purpose seems to be to incite not riot, but discussion. And so, what he's done is created a synthetic provocation, a confusing melange of real situations and completely fanciful ones, all of which add up to a very realistic explosion. That, I'm afraid, is not fighting fair. Lee's characters, who are all mouthpieces for various points of view, have no consistency. He pushes them around like so many chess pieces in a game without rules. And though his sharp timing and beautiful color compositions demonstrate just how far he's come as a filmmaker, he's not yet a skilled artist. His characters still preach at us, and his neighborhood is still an amalgam of convincing local types and clichés that seem drawn from socially conscious 30s movies. There's the lovable old bum who's full of Cracker Barrel wisdom, for instance, and the stuttering village idiot whose truths no one listens to. Spike Lee is coming along as a filmmaker, but he still has a way to go. It's a little premature to anoint this middle-class Brooklynite as the voice of America's black underclass.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57th. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we meet director and designer Drew Takahashi. He's animated logos for MTV and directed videos for Bobby McFerrin. Also, jazz historian Lauren Schoenberg profiles tenor saxophonist Herschel Evans, who played with the Basie Band. And Ken Tucker reviews the home video release of Child's Play. It's a horror movie about a boy's doll that's inhabited by the mind of a psycho killer. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, Karen Impala, and Steve Plever. Research assistants from Liz Trubert and Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.